From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made during an uncomfortable moment at a conference on the academic circuit, attended by economists and researchers and professors. Melissa Carney was one of the participants, and for hours she listened to her colleagues talk about income inequality, economic mobility, and related issues. And then during one of the later conference sessions, she decided to raise her hand and bring up an issue that almost all of her colleagues seemed to be avoiding. She asked, how should we think about the role of family and home environment in all of this? If we are talking about how people perform in school and the labor market, isn't the kind of household they grew up in an important determinant of that performance? In her new book, Carney describes what happened next. She writes, quote, there was quiet. After a few beats, I continued talking, rattling off a few statistics and facts about class gaps in marriage and family structure, then suggesting that these class gaps should probably be part of our conversations about inequality and mobility. I pointed out that college-educated adults are more likely than non-college-educated adults to get married and to raise kids in two-parent homes. The resources of these homes, including money, but also time and energy in the challenging work of parenting, separated them from less educated adults and their children, who lacked such resource luxuries. The data suggests that these differences across households produce large economic differences in the lives of children. Don't we need to contend with these facts? What should we make of them? And what, if anything, should policymakers do about them? End quote. Carney writes that her questions landed with a thud. Her colleagues mostly ignored the issue of how many kids are growing up with two parents at home. Some told her that, look, these are personal matters. These are not fair questions for her or really for anyone to be asking. These are individual decisions. In the years since, Carney has seen the same pattern. Her colleagues will talk about all kinds of advantage and disadvantage, but they won't talk about marriage rates. They won't talk about the rising number of American children growing up in single-parent households, usually just a mother. Carney notes a massive shift in American life in recent decades, and her focus is on what that means for kids. For the first time in American history, a narrow majority of middle-aged adults are living unmarried. In 1950, nearly 80% of households in the United States were composed of married couples. Now it's just below 50%. And look at the difference in the youngest age group of adults. 50 years ago, 60% of American adults between the ages of 18 and 34 were married. Now it's around 30%. Carney is concerned. She writes, quote, children born to highly educated, high-income parents are almost all being raised in highly resourced two-parent homes. They live in safe neighborhoods with well-funded schools, surrounded by high test-scoring peers. Most of them graduate from high school and then enroll in college. A majority of those who enroll in college graduate with a degree. In contrast, children born to unmarried parents are more likely to grow up in a one-parent household and are statistically less likely to have these resources or advantages. These children often live in low-income neighborhoods and attend inferior schools because they have no other choice. They graduate high school and enroll in college at lower rates. Those who do enroll in college are much less likely to earn a degree, end quote. Now, before her book even came out, Carney anticipated the critics, and some have already accused her of wanting to force women into unhappy unions or just blaming absent fathers or ignoring the legacies of racism in this country. To head that off, she writes, quote, I am not blaming single mothers. I am not diminishing the pernicious effects of racism in the United States. I am not saying everyone should get married. I am not dismissing non-resident fathers as absent from their children's lives or uninterested in being good dads. I am not promoting a norm of stay-at-home wife and a breadwinner husband. What I am doing is arguing through an appeal to data and rigorous studies that two parents tend to be able to provide their children with more resource advantages than one parent alone. And furthermore, that a two-parent family is increasingly becoming yet another privilege associated with more highly resourced groups in society. End quote. So what should we do with this data? How do we get here? How do we give children better lives? My guest this hour is Melissa Carney, a professor of economics at the University of Maryland, director of the Aspen Economic Strategy Group, a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institute, Institution, and the author of The Two-Parent Privilege, How Americans Stopped Getting Married and Started Falling Behind. Melissa, welcome. Thank you for making time for the program.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Can you take me back to that conference that you read about earlier in your book when you raised your concerns? I want to ask you why you think many of your colleagues, and probably true of many journalists as well, are so wary of talking about this. I mean, Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times had some positive things to say about your book, and And he said that he thinks among American liberals, this has been a blind spot.
I have been in so many conferences, so there is one in particular that I describe at the start of the book, but it's really fair to say that in the circles I run in, which tend not to be social conservative groups that talk about this kind of all the time, but more groups among higher education academics, Washington, D.C. think tank types, people who play on the sort of national policy stage, in that crowd, which I think is a really important crowd, there's a skittishness about acknowledging or prioritizing family structure as a policy matter. And there's a lot of good reasons why. So first, let me say, it's not that academics are blind to this. The work that I've done in my book and the research I draw on reflects dozens of academic studies that have shown these differences. So I just want to be clear, make sure all the readers, the listeners know this. I am not at all one of the first academics to show these facts. The challenge is when we try to bring these facts into sort of broader context, broader discussions, policy conversations, it's, do we really want scholars, academics, economists, policymakers saying that one type of family is better than another? And many of us are uncomfortable with making those kinds of judgments. It makes people uncomfortable, I think, out of good intentions, right? We want to be inclusive of all family types. And I'm trying to thread a needle here, which is say we should not return to an era where single mothers and their children were stigmatized and socially ostracized from communities. But we're doing kids in this country a major disservice by not acknowledging the fact that two-parent homes are beneficial to kids, and that the fact that now 30% of kids in the U.S., more than in any other country in the world, grows up with only one parent is really hindering the ability and the opportunities for millions of kids to reach their potential and to thrive. And so I think the reluctance to want to sound like we're judging people's life choices is part of it. A second issue, and this is what Nick Kristof brought up in his column that you referred to, is there is a racial element here at play, which is since the 1970s and 80s, white children in America are more likely to be living in married parent homes than black children. And a lot of work in the 80s or in the 70s started looking at those gaps. And some of that conversation, had really terrible stereotypes and implications involved in it. And sort of that racial element and the lack of sensitivity of some of the commentators or, acknowledgement of deep challenges. Kristof mentions Daniel Patrick Moynihan. Now, he wrote a memo in 1968 pointing to the differences between black and white families and really focused and emphasized the high unemployment rate among black men. And that's, part of the story here. So I think in some sense, his take was more sympathetic than maybe it was portrayed. But the racial element and the ugly racial conversations around the issue sort of shut it down for a long time. So that's another part of it. A third hesitation, I think, is that it's harder for us as economists, social scientists, and policymakers to know what to do with these trends than it is for us to know what to do about the fact that, let's say, the tax code isn't progressive enough. So we're just much more comfortable, and it's much more in our wheelhouse to say, here's how we should redesign transfer programs, or here's what schools should do, than to actually say, we need stronger families, because we don't have as obvious policy levers to pull.
My guest is Melissa Carney, whose new book has really been on fire. It's The Two-Parent Privilege, How Americans Stopped Getting Married and Started Falling Behind. And what I want to do is I want to work through some of what Professor Carney says are the misunderstandings or, maybe the common misconceptions. I'll also sort of address some of what I think are the straw man criticisms of the book. And then we'll have plenty of time for Professor Carney to talk about what the data is telling us. And we'll talk about prescriptions and what you do about this, along with some of, I think, what is the good faith criticism. But starting with dispelling points of confusion, You write that, you know, one notion is that people have this idea that, well, things are just changing. And yes, there are more children being raised by parents who are not married, but a lot of people now just don't get married. They still live together. And just because they're not married doesn't mean there aren't two parents there. And what you say is essentially, and I'm oversimplifying, but like that's not what's going on. Is that right?
I actually think that's an accurate simplification. That's really not what's going on in the U.S. In the U.S., the decline, so let's start with some numbers. In 1980, we had way more kids living in two-parent homes, so it was like 77% of kids, and that fell in the overall to 63% by 2020. So we had a massive decrease in the share of kids living in two-parent homes, larger outside the college-educated class. But the truth is that parents just living together in all but, you know, marriage and all but name is not what's accounting for the gap. So only 8% of kids live with one of their biological parents and an unmarried partner. So 8% of kids in sort of U.S. Census data live with what we would categorize as unmarried parents. But even that overstates it, because about a quarter to 40% of those unmarried partners are not the child's biological parents. And it further overstates it because those cohabiting unions in the U.S. are very fragile. And so, you know, many of them will transition and cycle. And so in the U.S., it's just practically the case that married parents that's the institution, marriage between parents, that's really delivering kids a household with two parents in it. And outside of that, it's just, you know, they're very fragile situations, and most of those kids wind up living with just their mom.
Okay. Another idea that, some of the early critics before they, I mean, the book is barely out, right? It's a few days old, isn't it? Isn't that right?
Came out last Monday, but the critics were ready to bite, by Monday night.
Well, and again, I think some of it's bad faith and some of it's good faith. And some of the bad faith stuff was, some of the bad faith stuff included, well, this is probably just an attack on, for example, same-sex marriage and a desire to see us go back to a time when the norm is expected to be a woman not working, raising children, and a man working, making money. And can you address both of those points?
I'm completely explicit about this in the book. In the book, I characterize same-sex couples as married couples or two-parent households, equivalent to, heterosexual couples. So I make no distinction in all of my data work, based on the sex of the parents, largely because I take a resource-based approach to all of this. I am an economist, right? And so this is all about, are there parents in the house combining and contributing resources to the development of the child? And so that whole debate is set outside. And I actually very explicitly say in the book that my read of the evidence such that it exists on whether there's a difference between two-parent households, if they're same-sex or different sex, it doesn't look like there's any meaningful difference to children's outcomes. So I'm explicit about that. I'm also explicit about the fact that I am completely agnostic as to how two-parent or married-parent couples make their family situation work. And for some of them, you know, somebody stays home the majority or entirety of their children's childhood. In others, it's the dad who stays home, or the mom or the dad stays home, or they both work full-time all the time. My point, again, is because I'm focused on resources, two-parent, married-parent homes have more options. Somebody can stay home, somebody can work. Someone can work part-time, another person can work full-time. They just have more options. And so I, take no stand as to which option any individual family exercises, and I have nothing to say about what's better in that sense.
Okay. And then another idea is, well, you know, we've seen women make gains, not to parity, but make gains economically, and cultural norms are changing, and maybe this this rise in single-parent households led by the mother is just a case of successful women, single women, deciding that they can handle having a child because they're much better off, et cetera. You write that, no, in fact, single mothers are disproportionately neither college educated nor high income.
It is decidedly not the most economically successful women in U.S. society who are choosing to be single moms in large numbers. Only 12% of kids whose mom have a four-year college degree live with an unpartnered mother, as compared to 30% of kids whose mom does not have a four-year college degree. So this is not an economic success story.
Another aspect is how truly American this issue is. And the Wall Street Journal, in reviewing your book, writes, they note that in 1960, 5% of babies were born to unwed mothers in the United States. And almost 60 years later, it was almost 50%. And the Wall Street Journal, and Tom sends us this note, a listener sending us this note saying, here's how the Wall Street Journal characterized it. U.S. children are the most likely in the world to live with only one parent now.
The Pew Research Survey Center did this amazing survey of 130 countries in the world and came up with this startling fact that the high rate of children in the U.S. living with one parent is more than three times the international average. And again, this idea that, oh, people here are just being more European, there are far more children, a higher share of children in the U.S. living in one-parent homes than in Europe, right? We have like over 20%. They have closer to 13%. So this is a distinctly American phenomenon, and I would say challenge.
So the question becomes then, what is the way forward here? And one of the points that you write about that I found really interesting is the notion of what has impacted men, in particular, marriageable men, men who are able, if they don't have college degrees, to have solid incomes, consistent incomes, good jobs, and what might make them, I guess people would say marriage material, or stable and consistent and solid. And if we saw a reversal of the trend away from employing, so what we know, I guess, is that men are struggling more with depression, opioid addiction, especially in rural America. They're working less. And if we somehow fixed that, would we then see more children born to two-parent households? And you draw on not only the fracking boom, but also two different stories that are 20 years apart that you raise as kind of a point that I took to mean there are cultural norms changing that you are not comfortable with. But tell me about that.
Yeah, this is something my view on this has evolved. So 10 years ago, if you asked me this question, I would say what we have to do is improve the economic position of non-college educated men. There were a number of secular shocks to the labor market, to the global economy in the 80s and 90s and early 2000s that really hurt the economic standing of non-college educated men in this country, both in an absolute sense, but importantly, relative to women. So, let me just give one example. In towns that were heavily employed in, or in areas where a lot of employment was in manufacturing, when the U.S. started importing more manufactured goods from China and manufacturing employment rates went down, these communities lost a lot of good-paying jobs for non-college-educated men. And in those communities, as a result, we see a reduction in marriage and an increase in the share of kids living in single mother homes. Okay, so there's a causal link that has been established between economic losses among non-college educated men and a rise in the share of kids living with just their moms. So the fracking boom provides a nice opportunity to study what happens in the reverse. What happens when something comes in a local area that increases the employment and wages of non-college educated men in an absolute sense and relative to non-college educated women? And the fracking boom did that. Let's abstract from what happened in North Dakota and South Dakota, where there was a lot of migrant workers. But in the other counties in the country there was fracking, what my colleague and I found when we studied that is there was an increase in births, but in equal proportion to both unmarried and married individuals, there was no increase in marriage and there was no reduction in the share of kids born outside of a marriage. And so this was, this gave me pause to this idea that simply increasing the economic attractiveness of men would sort of automatically lead to an increase in marriage as it did 20 years earlier. So you referred to a different response 20 years earlier. I'm looking here at the coal boom and bust in the 70s and 80s and similarly rural communities in the U.S., when coal prices went up and the earnings of men in coal-producing areas of Appalachia went up, there was an increase in marriage, an increase in married births, a reduction in the non-marital birth share. And so the point here is you have a very similar economic shock in similar types of communities, one in the 1980s, one in the early 2000s. In the 1980s, when there was still a very strong social norm or convention of having kids inside a marriage, we saw that family formation response. In the early 2000s, that convention was much looser, again, primarily outside the college-educated class, just looking at the numbers. There was a large share of kids already being born outside marriage. So when men's earnings went up, couples or people had more kids, whether or not they were married. And so that and other types of evidence have really led me to conclude, as I do in this book, that what we're seeing is the reflection of both economics and social changes, and reversing it will require both an improvement in the economic circumstances. And as you mentioned, these economic circumstances of men, there's a lot of associated issues, right? Out of work men are more likely to be depressed, have substance abuse issues. We need to address all that. But also, I don't think we're going to get a return to the high share of kids living in two-parent homes if there's not also a recommitment to that social convention.
We're talking to Melissa Carney, the author of the new book, The Two-Parent Privilege, How Americans Stopped Getting Married and Started Falling Behind. Professor Carney is a professor of economics at the University of Maryland and director of the Aspen Economic Strategy Group, a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution as well. And let me now address some of the points that I think your many readers have already raised. And I'll go back to Nick Kristof, for example. He raises a point about reproductive rights. He says that now is the time to defend and support, for example, abortion rights and contraception to make sure we don't see even more children born into one-parent households. And yet, the move across the country is to take reproductive rights away from women in many places, and that is only going to make the problem that is described in your book worse. Do you agree with him?
I do agree that if it's harder for women to avoid an unplanned or an unintended pregnancy, then we will have more children conceived to unmarried couples. And so those two, you know, that movement is at odds with any sort of social goal of increasing the share of children born to married parents or raised in married parent homes. Having said that, I just want to clarify back to our conversation about what is and isn't driving these trends. You know, in the pre-Dobbs world, which is when my study is set, it's not that there's been an increase in births to groups that have typically had high rates of single parenthood. So tremendously, teen births in the U.S. have fallen by over 70% since the early 90s. All women under the age of 20 basically are having fewer births than they used to. And so the rise in single parenthood is not because of an increase in birth. It's because of a decoupling of having kids and being married. So it really reflects a decrease in marriage. But the point it holds that if we go back to a regime where unintended pregnancies become more common, we will see an increase in the share of kids being raised in single parent homes.
Okay. I've also seen you point out in several interviews about your book that, you know, that you've tried to engage what you think is the fair criticism, but the one that you don't really, the one that you hear quite often, but you don't really appreciate, I think, is the idea that, well, the problem is not that kids are being born more often into households with only one parent or one active parent. It's that there aren't resources to support that parent. And if we improve the social safety net, that would take care a lot of the problem. Can you talk about that?
The reason why I'm increasingly impatient with that highly anticipated line of pushback is because it's right on its face, in my view, that we don't do enough to support low-income kids in this country. And in all of the policy work I have done over the past 15 years, I have argued and, you know, advocated for more resources to low-income kids in this country. So let me stipulate that that is, in my view, entirely true. We do not do enough to support those kids. We have mounds of evidence showing that alleviating the material deprivation of kids in this country would have long-term benefits. So I completely agree that we should do more. The reason I wrote this book is because so many of us keep pushing on that. And again, it's that's frustrating in itself because, you know, people who profess to be pro-family, pro-kids are some of the ones blocking these kinds of additional public expenditures. But when you look at the data at how much more likely kids living with moms only, and to a lesser extent, but still more than two parents, dads only, how much more likely they are to be living in under-resourced homes, how much more likely those children are to show up at school with challenges and being less prepared to learn, how much more likely those kids are to get in trouble in school, to fall behind academically. At some point, we have to also push on improving home life and family structure. There's only so much the government or schools are going to be able to do to make up for deficits in the home. The other reason why I think that pushback misses a big point is, yes, we could do more to ensure that kids living with single parents don't live in poverty. Okay, so kids living with a mother only are five times more likely to live in poverty than kids in a two-parent home. We should do more to close that gap. But this isn't just about keeping kids out of poverty. The privilege I talk about that kids with two parents have is they are twice as likely to graduate college. So I want more for kids than just keeping them out of poverty. I want more kids to have a resourceful home environment, be well set up to thrive in school and to be able to get through college, and a stronger safety net, a child tax credit that gives families an additional $2,000 a year. I am all for it, but it's not going to close these gaps. And so if we sort of set our goals higher as what we want for kids, we need to move beyond just this perennial focus on shoring up the safety net and really think about closing class gaps and outcomes and figuring out ways that would deliver a more, you know, resourceful household for a kid. And that tends to be a two-parent household.
Now, I do take your point that it's not just about pulling someone across a poverty line, but really helping kids thrive. But I do think, you know, there are plenty of people, whether they're on the political left or even Senator Mitt Romney and others, who've called for some form of a continued child tax credit. We saw about a year of it before it expired and has not been renewed. And yeah. I think there is pretty good data that pulled a significant number of kids, at least temporarily, across the poverty line, didn't it?
Oh, yeah, 100%. It's an absolute disgrace, and it's inexcusable that we've let that expire. During a pandemic, during a recession, we did something we haven't been able to do, which is reduce rates of child poverty by as much as 40%. So we saw almost how easy it would be to solve, you know, some of this material challenge in a given year if we just sent low-income families a larger tax credit. We should 100% continue doing that.
You're saying that's not enough. That's not sufficient to get to where you want to go. Okay. What we're going to do is, after our only break of the hour here, we're going to get to where some of some of the other feedback from the book. And then I see Rich on the phone. I've got some emails, Charles, among others. We'll take your emails as well. We're talking to Melissa Carney, who is the author of the new book, The Two-Parent Privilege: How Americans Stopped Getting Married and Started Falling Behind. We're right back after this only break. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, Rochesterians might know the story of Corpus or Spiritus Christi, and a breakaway church that had its issues with the Catholic Church over ordination, among many other issues. But in the mainstream Catholic Church, the move toward women's ordination continues, and we're going to talk about where it stands on Thursday on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Professor Carney, I think what some of your critics are saying is that they're not seeking to replace two active parents in the household with a situation where you have one parent and just a stronger social safety net. They wouldn't view that as an even trade-off. I think what they are arguing is that the way you get more two-parent households to begin with is to build a stronger social safety net in the first place. And here's an example. I'm going to quote from author and social commentator Rebecca Traister, who's the author of the 2016 book called All the Single Ladies, Unmarried Women, and the Rise of an Independent Nation. She writes, quote, Carney is correct that marriage, in the decades that it has been increasingly optional, has become the purview of the wealthy. It is an institution that allows the already economically stable to become even more stable by combining their resources. Marriage, once a narrow entrance into adulthood, now more frequently serves as a rewarding capstone life event, agreed to by two well-resourced people who have the advantages of sexual liberation, educational attainment, professional achievement, and economic security under their belt, as well as the freedom to exit their unions should they turn out to be unsatisfying. But where Carney is wrong, incredibly, monumentally wrong, is that the solution to this structural inequality is simply encouraging more marriage for more people. She confuses cause and effect and is incorrect in the claim that marital privilege is the cause of the inequity rather than a further symptom of it. The solution is not marriage. It's money and the racist and economically unjust policies that leave some Americans with less of it to begin with, regardless of their marital status, are still in the way. For those of us who have money, marriage is likely to help to find even more of it. For those who find a good match, there are many emotional and societal rewards of partnership. But you need stability first. You need the money, jobs, housing, and health care first. End quote. So what do you make of that?
Well, the thing that's most frustrating about that to me is when she says I'm monumentally wrong because I confuse cause and effect. I have like three chapters in the book talking about how this is both cause and effect. I couldn't be more explicit about how the forces that have driven widening inequality in the U.S. have in part driven this divergence in family structure. And in fact, I've conducted academic research showing that, for example, you know, kids who grow up in economically disadvantaged circumstances, if they live in a more unequal place, they're more likely to become teen moms themselves. So even my own research shows that cause. What I think, you know, that author is wrong about is then denying that there's also effect. So the arrows very clearly run in both directions, that economics changes family structure, and then the divergence in family structure widens inequality. And very mechanically, what we see is, let me just give you a very specific example. Households headed by a mom with a high school degree, you know, their high school educated parents over the 40 years I studied, their earnings went up on average by 8%. But their household earnings went down by 4%. Why? Because they are now 20 percentage points more likely to live with only one adult in the house. So economics here is both cause and effect, very clearly. The point about what we need to encourage marriage is a stronger safety net, quite frankly, is a point I wanted to make in the book because, as I've said, I have long advocated for a stronger safety net. I could find no compelling evidence suggesting that's true. The evidence suggests that a stronger safety net, more support to low-income families, regardless of marriage structure, will, if anything, increase the share of single-parent homes. I am also very clear in the book that I am willing to take that trade, despite everything I've said about, you know, the disadvantages kids from single-parent households experience. My read of the evidence is that stronger sort of safety net support leads to a smaller increase in single parenthood, but has tremendous benefits for children. And ultimately, my goal here is to really improve the well-being of kids. So I think, you know, it's both, her piece is a bit of a mischaracterization of what I'm saying in the book, but then also leans too heavily on this notion that I can't find evidence for. And to be clear, like, my book really is very evidence-based. Now, the point about money, you know, again, I am all for helping close some of these gaps in resources between one and two parent households with more public income. But here's too where I think people arguing, like, let's just do that and not try to figure out why so many parents outside the college-educated class aren't raising their kids in a two-parent home are being, you know, far too flippant about is that a second parent does way more than just bring home a check. And by the way, typically a paycheck much more than what the government, you know, would provide. But parents do a lot more than that. They spend time with their kids. They supervise their kids. They are role models for their kids. They nurture their children. And, you know, even if we manage to double or triple the amount of cash benefits we're giving households, a government check can't do that. And so here's where I think the college-educated class, you know, they're raising their kids in two-parent homes. How many parents do you know? They're obsessing about their kids. They're driving them all over to their different sports practices, their, you know, music classes. They're helping them with their homework. But then they're willing to say, hey, outside the college-educated class, marriage just doesn't work. So, but let's not try to find out why or increase the share of kids with married parents. Let's just send them, you know, a stronger government check. That just doesn't feel as productive or generous, frankly, as I think, you know, people like Rebecca mean it to be.
On the subject of race, I want to read an email from a listener named Sean, and I'll just read some data that Melissa Carney shares in her book. White and Asian children are significantly more likely to live with married parents as compared to Hispanic and Black children. In 2019, 77% of white children and 88% of Asian children lived with married parents in this country. The share among Hispanic children was 62%. Only 38% of Black children live with married parents, a historically low share that reflects a downward trend over four decades. Sean writes to the program the following. Evan, what really spiked marriage rates in this country was the super racist policies of subsidizing housing for white families in the 50s and 60s. Evan, you literally just had a conversation on your show yesterday about what those racist covenants said. No Black people allowed in the suburbs. It's no surprise that Black couples didn't get married at the same rates, considering they couldn't even find housing. Now we have a problem that is decades in the making. Black people have a lot less wealth than white people in this country, and as a result, their lives are less stable, more chaotic. Fix that problem, and more will get married, and more kids will grow up with two parents at home. That is from Sean. What do you think, Melissa?
I agree with everything Sean has said. There are, you know, a lot of structural reasons why the share of kids living in two-parent homes has been higher among white families than Black families. We have a terrible legacy of discrimination in this country, in the labor market, in the criminal justice system, in residential segregation, as he refers to. All of that, I agree entirely with his observation. This has led to this really damaging position. My point is, like, we need to actually get at that those root causes and commit ourselves to turning things around. Otherwise, you know, those affected kids growing up in those communities and in those demographic groups with really low rates of two-parent households, they are going to be at a disadvantage when the minute they show up at school. And there's only so much schools can do. And so we have to say, what is keeping these couples from being able to achieve healthy relationships, to being able to co-parent, to commit to long-term cohabitation or marriage, and what can we do to turn it around? On the point of Black families being particularly affected by these trends, there's really sobering and compelling work that came out of the Opportunity Insights team at Harvard showing that Black boys in particular are more likely to grow, you know, they grow up in neighborhoods as compared to white boys. Let me say this differently. White and Black boys growing up in the same neighborhood, the strongest predictor of whether, you know, Black boys do as well as the white boys when they grow up, so the predictor of upward mobility, a smaller racial gap in adult earnings, is how many Black dads are around in the neighborhood. And also levels of discrimination where they grow up. And so the point here is that in neighborhoods where there's a lot of Black boys, and we just know that a lot of Black boys are growing up in households without a dad around, that it impedes their own upward mobility. But even at a neighborhood level, the absence of Black dads from a neighborhood, the existence of discrimination, that holds those boys down. And so, of course, we need to continue to fight all of the levers of discrimination, and we also need to get at root causes about what's keeping so many Black families from, you know, a healthy marriages, stable marriages.
So let me grab here Rich in Rochester has been waiting on the phone. Hi, Rich, go ahead.
Hey, Evan, how are you doing?
Good, sir.
In listening to your guests, I don't think there's any argument that more resources in a home equate to more flexibility, more support for a child. I don't think that's the issue. I think what she just touched on is a huge issue. If we build a society where we are always pushing to keep certain groups down, keep certain groups from not achieving, this doesn't change. I don't see her saying anything that is something new and something like we've never heard before. But until we can really change our socioeconomic ways that we handle each other. I mean, you look at Southern states who say we'll keep people poor without welfare if that means that we have to take our poverty line and take it down to $1,000. The deep-rooted racism within this country, even here in the North, I watch gentrification going on here in Rochester. A Black family can't get money to fix a house. All of a sudden, a white family buys that same house, and all of a sudden, they can get money to fix that house. When you have those kinds of pressure on you, why would you get married? Why in your society would you get married? What do you have to bring to that lady? What do you have to bring to that man? But yet we all have our needs to make emotional, sexual connections. So all of this stuff that she's saying is not new. And to me, it's like, so what? I've heard this all my life. I've seen it all my life. The problem that I see is that you're going to take different people, say you're conservatives or you're Christians, and say, you know, that's because God's not in the household, this and that. There's no prescription here that's new. And for me, the frustrating thing is I'm hearing nothing new from her. These are things that I've known all my life and I've watched all my life.
Rich, let me just jump in. I appreciate the phone call. So, Melissa, what do you think is new in terms of what we do about this? I mean, I know these are complex issues. I understand that. That's why there's a book and not just a short paragraph. But when you do try to condense it and tell people, look, I've given you the data, here's what we have to do next, what's the answer?
So, your caller's right that people have been saying this for years. I mean, we already mentioned, or you mentioned, Moynihan said in 1965, we have a problem. 30% of Black kids in this country are born outside of wedlock, as we refer to it at the time, and 5% of white kids are. We are now at a position where 30% of white kids and 70% of Black kids are born outside of a marital union. And so the numbers just keep growing. And what I'm trying to do in this book is say, we can't just keep letting this go on and deciding that family, strengthening families is not a policy priority. It has to be a policy priority. And there are things, you know, that if we were to agree that strengthening families, strengthening, you know, increasing the share of kids who have two-parent homes is a policy priority, I think we'd be doing different things. So let me give you one concrete example. Only 1% of the Federal Administration for Children and Families budget goes to programs called Promoting Safe and Stable Families, as compared to 15% for foster care, or far more amount of money to Head Start, which itself is underfunded. We don't do enough to get at the root causes. Like your caller was saying, if you have these men who are out of work, who struggle with, you know, they're in and out of prison, why would a woman marry them? Why would they feel like they could commit to taking care of a family? We need to bolster the kinds of programs that are working with vulnerable families, working on responsible fatherhood, working on preventing intimate partner violence. We need to actually commit to helping families, not just continuing to talk about what schools and the government needs to do to make up for for vulnerable families. The other point that I think really is important not to lose sight of is that this is not just an issue predominantly for Black families in America anymore. And so the gaps between Black and white families emerged in the 60s and 70s. What's happened in the 40 years since is a college gap. And that's really the big data story I'm telling in the book. You know, even among the children of Black moms now, those whose moms have a college degree are twice as likely to be living with married parents. And so that college gap has emerged within white families, within Hispanic families, within Black families. And so now what we're really talking about is both a socioeconomic education class divide, as well as these longer-term racial differences.
All right, let me try to get through as much as I can here. We're going to move fast here. Sarah wants to know, does your guest support laws to make it harder to get divorced?
That's a good question. It is not something that I'm a proponent of for a number of reasons. Liberalizing divorce laws has made it more possible for women to leave abusive, violent, really damaging relationships, and I wouldn't advocate turning back the clock on that.
Okay. Jennifer wants to know, the assumption of this conversation is based on a more recent cultural sense of two-parent families on their own in the world. I'm always curious about the assimilated Americanized shift to nuclear families versus extended families, grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins involved in closer living situations or communities. How does this question factor into the conversation about not just economic success, but overall well-being of families? That's from Jennifer, and it makes me think of the book Everyday Utopia by Kristen Godsey, in which Godsey writes that the so-called nuclear family is a relatively modern invention, defying much of the typical family structure throughout human history. What do you think, Melissa?
I firmly subscribe to this view that it takes a village to raise a child, that extended family are super wonderful and important. And we can talk about the shift to a nuclear family away from an extended family as part of a separate trend that's making life harder for American families. But just as a very practical fact, I looked in the data to see how many single moms were making up for the absence of a second parent in the house with a grandparent or an aunt or uncle in the house. And it was smaller than we might think. So 67% of kids who live with single moms have no other adults in the house. You know, conversely, 22% of them have a grandma or a grandpa in the house. So grandparents, extended family are helping out single parents, but they're not making up for the absence of a second parent in the house. The other thing I looked for was I saw no evidence that I could find suggesting that kids who live with single moms are more likely to, you know, have frequent contact with their extended family. So extended family seems to be something that benefits both married and single parents in the U.S.
Charles writes, obviously, this is an important issue to tackle. Given that the number one predictor of crime is fatherless homes, the best course of action would be preemptive in nature, teaching people that their actions have consequences rather than encouraging them to hit the reset button. But since it's apparent that it's not going to happen, if the biological father refuses to raise the kid, the next best solution is to find another positive, strong male role model. Teacher, coach, priest, Boy Scout troop leader, whoever, any of these can be a, quote, dad, and one of them stepping up will yield positive results. That's from Charles. What do you think?
Role models are critically important here. And we know that, you know, role models can fill in some of the gap. There's a lot of good evidence that role models and mentors are filling in the gap. You know, meeting kids where they are and filling in is really, really important. And I support all of that. Ultimately, I think our ideal should be more of those kids, more of those boys have an involved dad in their life.
What is the single piece of criticism of your book that you've heard so far that you think is the most fair?
I think, you know, people who read the same evidence I read characterize it as I've characterized it. This is both cause and effect, they're root causes, but ultimately conclude that we're not going to make progress on increasing marriage and we have to come up with robust alternatives. That to me is a defensible position. Again, I sort of reject that because I feel like that's giving up on too many families, just resigning ourselves to having millions of kids, not having the benefit of two parents. So I don't come to that conclusion, but maybe I'm too optimistic in thinking that there's anything we could do to turn this around.
All right. And in 30 seconds or so, what is a realistic hope that you have that this book will help yield? Do you think it will sort of normalize the at least this part of the conversation that has been lacking?
My hope is that this book can take this issue out of the culture wars and give us a productive way to talk about it so that collectively people who are working with families in the communities, in the schools, in the policy sphere can come up with productive ways to help strengthen families in a way that, you know, feels like it's not attacking or blaming anybody, because we have to see this as the policy priority it needs to be.
I mean, the culture wars are going to absolutely grab this book, but I take that last point. One of the goals of this program is to try to get away from the over-politicization of everything. But I understand, you know, there's going to be a lot of conversations about this. The book is called The Two-Parent Privilege, How Americans Stopped Getting Married and Started Falling Behind. Melissa Carney is the author, a professor of economics at the University of Maryland. Thank you for making the time. I know you are in demand with this. Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you.
All right, that's Melissa Carney. Listeners, if we didn't get to questions, comments, I'm sure there'll be a lot more to talk about on these subjects in the weeks to come. From the whole team at Connections, thank you for listening. We're back with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.